Chapter 10, Flat-Ass Stalled. Democrats were still in a season of good feelings when Joe Biden took the stage at the Pabst Theater near the Milwaukee Riverfront on February 16th. The president and his congressional allies were still grinding through the final details of the American Rescue Plan, but victory was close. The coronavirus pandemic was not over, but cases were falling rapidly. About 40 million Americans had been vaccinated, with more than a million people getting new shots every day. The president was in Wisconsin for a town hall-style event moderated by the CNN anchor Anderson Cooper. It unfolded smoothly enough until Jocelyn Fish, a marketing director at a community theater, asked Biden about student debt. Telling him that education-related debt was crushing her family and friends, Fish urged Biden to consider canceling all student loan debt up to $50,000. Biden rejected the idea. He had already endorsed debt cancellation up to $10,000, but he had been resisting pleas to go higher from liberals as mighty as Bernie Sanders, Elizabeth Warren, and Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. Even Chuck Schumer, a more recent convert to the cause, had pressed Biden in private on the subject, arguing that relieving student debts would be an enormous blessing to working-class people of color, the core of his political base. Biden had not been persuaded, and Jocelyn Fish was not about to change his mind. "I will not make that happen," Biden told her. He said he wanted to give people a measure of debt relief, but he was not about to forgive the debt, the billions of dollars of debt for people who have gone to Harvard and Yale and Penn. The unsupportive answer left no room for uncertainty or interpretation. It was a repudiation that seemed to come mainly from the president's gut. Student loan debt was a widespread American affliction that burdened more than 43 million borrowers, few of whom attended expensive Ivy League schools. But Biden plainly associated hefty debts with fancy universities and recoiled from the idea of bailing out the privileged. "I went to a state school," he noted on CNN. The comments sent a shudder through the progressive wing of Biden's party, drawing a thread of frustrated tweets from Ocasio-Cortez and a stern joint statement from Schumer and Warren. Biden's advisors had been urging the left to be patient, stressing that the administration had not finalized its policies on student debt. But Biden seemed to have demolished those claims in Milwaukee. Or had he? Within 24 hours, the White House Press Secretary Jen Psaki tempered Biden's remarks. The Justice Department would conduct a legal review of the debt cancellation issue, she said, and that would shape how the president proceeded. In private, Biden's chief of staff spoke with several congressional supporters of debt cancellation to assure them his boss had not intended to take such a firm position. One lawmaker who spoke with Ron Klain recalled him saying gently that sometimes Biden gets a little tangled up in his public statements. When a group of House progressives raised the subject again with Klain in a meeting several weeks later, the trusted aide alluded to Biden's comments as an error. "We corrected that the next day, right?" Klain said, according to one lawmaker's recollection. The blunder blew over quickly, but the moment had exposed real disagreements within the Democratic Party, even in a period of relative unity. The party had closed ranks around Biden for nearly a year, first to drive Donald Trump from office, and then to pass an urgent pandemic relief bill into law. Yet Biden's political coalition remained complex, containing a great diversity of ideologies, identities, and political priorities. Biden had made grand and sometimes contradictory promises to nearly every faction, pledging to transform the economy and social fabric of the United States while restoring a spirit of normalcy to Washington and reaching across the aisle to work with Republicans. Though he had passed the rescue package on a party-line vote, Biden remained serious about the last of those goals. He continued to tell advisors and lawmakers that the world needed to see that Americans could work together in order to restore the global reputation of American democracy. Once he won the fight for the American Rescue Plan, Biden faced the tangled task of working through the rest of his stated agenda. The bulk of his party expected nothing less than an all-out push for Democratic priorities on taxes, climate, health care, infrastructure, voting rights, policing, immigration, gun violence, and so much more. The Democrats' centrist wing was eager to address many of these issues too, but with more incremental legislation and, ideally, with Republican partners. In this next phase of Biden's young presidency, he and his advisors would confront just how hard it would be to keep his promises and how quickly his party might fracture if he did not. Facing mounting legislative adversity, Biden would eventually settle on a complex, two-pronged strategy for managing Congress and the two parties. On one side, he would hold talks with Republicans and centrist Democrats on infrastructure legislation, and on the other side, he would work with his party's liberal majority to devise another multi-trillion-dollar reconciliation bill containing many of the Democrats' larger spending priorities. If Biden and his party's congressional leaders managed everything just right, they could satisfy the moderate wing of their party with an infrastructure bill and earn their cooperation on much larger legislation that would pass solely with Democratic votes. Or so the theory went. It was a difficult path, and in the spring and early summer of 2021, the first signs of dissension began to appear at every level of the Democratic Party, even within Biden's White House, in the office of his vice president. Until the end of winter, Joe Biden's political honeymoon with his fellow Democrats was still very much in progress. The White House had embarked early on the kind of congressional charm offensive that Democrats had never enjoyed during the Trump years, and that few had experienced even during Barack Obama's administration. To Obama, courting House committee chairs and mid-level senators had been a tedious chore, one that many of his young aides spoke about with an eye-rolling ennui that lawmakers could only experience as insulting. Biden had a different attitude toward the Hill, and in the first months of his administration, it showed. He and his aides showered congressional Democrats with attention, hosting dozens of lawmakers at the White House in the first month of his presidency and holding larger virtual meetings between the president and scores more. When he hosted a group of House committee chairs in the Oval Office in February, Biden welcomed them with lavish enthusiasm for the role he hoped they would play in shaping policy. Biden wooed Republicans, too, with the trappings of his office. He had not managed to achieve a breakthrough with the GOP on pandemic relief, but in private meetings, Biden insisted that he wanted bipartisan support for parts of his agenda. The new president seemed sensitive to complaints from Republicans that his more liberal staff was hostile to the idea of compromise. In a mid-February meeting with a bipartisan group of mayors and governors, Biden drew an explicit distinction between himself and his aides, according to Francis Suarez, the Republican mayor of Miami who attended the meeting. The president wanted to pursue cooperation where possible, and so that is what his administration would do. "I let them handle the fine points of policy," Biden said of his staff, according to Suarez, "but I handle the politics." For the most part, the subjects of Biden's charm offensive were his fellow Democrats. He used many of the meetings to underline his respect for the different foundational constituencies of the Democratic Party. In his Oval Office meeting with House chairs, Biden made an emphatic statement of his support for the union movement, pointing his index finger into the seat cushion next to him and declaring that they were in labor's house. When he met with the executive committee of the Congressional Black Caucus in April, Biden was even more solicitous. After the group of lawmakers sat down with the president, Biden rose to acknowledge a deep political debt. "I want you all to know you're the reason I'm here," Biden said, according to one person's recollection. The president told the group they could expect to spend more time in the Oval Office. "There's a lot of work for us to do," he said. In one early virtual meeting with Senate moderates, Biden's long relationship with Congress showed in a vivid, if unintentional, way. He kept addressing Mark Warner, the centrist Democrat from Virginia, as John, as in John Warner, the Republican whom Mark Warner succeeded in the Senate, a man with whom Biden served for three decades. It was the kind of senior moment that Biden's colleagues took note of, though in this case they found it endearing. At the end of February, Politico reported that Biden had already hosted almost 50 members of the House and Senate in the Oval Office, offering some of them their debut visits to the storied room. John Tester, the third-term Montana senator, startled even Biden's aides when he disclosed that an early visit with Biden in the Oval was the first time he had ever been in the room. Biden was surprised, too. Getting shut out of the White House in the Trump years was one thing, but Tester had been in Congress throughout the Obama presidency. How, Biden wondered aloud, was it possible that he had never been in the Oval Office before? During this period, Democrats had reasons to celebrate Biden besides their new access to the White House grounds. The American Rescue Plan was proving popular, sending aid checks to millions of families and generating a huge wave of local headlines about narrowly averted cuts to law enforcement, transit, and more. The scale of funding going into distressed localities was staggering. Multi-billion-dollar packages for metropolises like New York and Chicago, but also giant sums for smaller cities like Akron, Ohio, which received more than $150 million, and Laredo, Texas, which got nearly $100 million. The relief money was so popular that even conservative Republican governors were finding themselves hard-pressed to complain. "We'll put that money to work," acknowledged Pete Ricketts, the Republican governor of Nebraska whose wealthy family bankrolled the national GOP. In Mississippi, Tate Reeves, a conservative governor who thirsted for national media attention, scolded Democrats for the ridiculous size of the rescue plan, but conceded he might try to use its funds to patch his state's shoddy water infrastructure. Most telling might have been a rupture over relief funds between Florida's pro-Trump Republican Governor Ron DeSantis and its equally ambitious Republican Senator Rick Scott. Scott, an eccentric former health care executive with designs on the presidency, called for governors and mayors to reject rescue plan money. DeSantis, who had a long-running rivalry with Scott, dismissed the idea. "It doesn't make any sense," DeSantis countered, arguing that Florida deserved its fair share. With rare exceptions like his trip to Milwaukee in February, Biden did not spend much time on the road hawking his accomplishments in the first few months of his presidency. His aides were hyper-vigilant about protecting the president from the coronavirus and limited his travel accordingly, but he had promised Democrats over and over that he was going to be an enthusiastic salesman when the time was right. It was one of the rare subjects on which Biden openly criticized the previous White House he served in. The Obama administration, he believed, did not do enough to explain its policies to the country. In the glow of victory, Democrats expected Biden would soon begin to make the hard sell for his achievements. He would not, they believed, trust his administration's work to speak for itself. Biden, after all, had learned from the mistakes of his old boss. "Obama thought salesmanship was beneath him," says Tim Kaine, the Virginia senator and close Obama ally, adding that he meant that in an affectionate way. His prediction in May? Biden and his team are not going to repeat that mistake. At the time, it was easy to understand Kaine's confidence. After all, Biden spent much of 2010 campaigning for Democrats who lost badly in the midterm elections that year. Few understood better than Biden the price his party could pay if they did not define and defend their expansive agenda. On March 22nd, two of Biden's senior advisors made the case to Senate Democrats that the new administration was on the right political track. During a virtual meeting, Biden's longtime political counselor Mike Donilon and his top political aide Jennifer O'Malley-Dillon delivered a presentation arguing that the Biden-Harris coalition was a muscular and stable force. They walked Senate Democrats through an assessment of Biden's strength in 2020 with voters of color, women, independents, suburbanites, and young people, and said the party now had to sell its achievements to those voters and more. "In 2020, we brought the right voters to the table and persuaded them to support us. We need to constantly talk to and deepen our support among key components of our coalition," the two said, according to a copy of their presentation. For starters, Donilon and O'Malley-Dillon said that meant promoting the American Rescue Plan aggressively until the next election in 2022. "In addition to the ARP," they said, "we need to stay on the offensive between now and November 2022 by highlighting this administration's efforts on popular issues, e.g. health care, infrastructure, and highlighting GOP obstruction of common sense legislation." It was the kind of broad and simple strategy that had sustained Biden through a tumultuous 2020 primary and general election. The Biden-era Democratic Party would do popular stuff, promote it tirelessly, and chastise Republicans for standing in the way. Democrats just had to stay in line and stick to the plan. One Democrat was not in the mood to fall in line that evening. Like many Asian American lawmakers, Tammy Duckworth remained frustrated that Biden and his team had not managed to put a single person of that background in charge of a cabinet department. She and other Asian Americans in Congress had given Biden's team so many names to consider, only to see all of them passed over, in many cases for white people with close ties to the president. With two of Biden's closest advisors on the line, Duckworth seized the chance to raise the issue again. O'Malley Dillon tried to placate the former helicopter pilot by pointing to the most prominent person of Asian descent in the White House, Kamala Harris, whose mother was Indian American. "We are incredibly proud of the vice president," O'Malley Dillon told Duckworth. It was a line Duckworth had heard from other white people in Biden's inner circle. She found it condescending. No one had told the Congressional Black Caucus that they should be satisfied with a black vice president and nothing else. The Illinois senator laced into O'Malley Dillon and made her anger public the following day, telling reporters on the Hill that the Biden advisor's comments had been incredibly insulting. Then Duckworth offered the White House an abrupt reminder of what one angry senator could do to their agenda. She vowed she would not vote to confirm a single Biden nominee who did not represent diversity until Biden did something about the paucity of Asian American people in senior administration roles. The White House was rattled by the threat. Duckworth's ultimatum itself was troubling, since they could not afford to lose any Democratic votes on contentious nominations. More concerning still was the precedent it might set if the administration allowed Democratic senators to hold the White House hostage one by one. Steve Ricchetti called Duckworth with a firm but diplomatic message. "You've issued an ultimatum to the president," the Biden advisor told her. "We don't like ultimatums." The senator was undeterred. "You guys give in to Joe Manchin's ultimatums on a daily basis," Duckworth shot back. "What's wrong with an Asian American issuing one?" Ricchetti could not help chuckling. Duckworth had a point. After the negotiations with Manchin around the American Rescue Plan, the administration could hardly claim it had a blanket policy of not rewarding senatorial brinksmanship. In this case, Duckworth relented for a modest price. The White House quickly agreed to name a former aide of hers, Erica Moritsugu, to a senior role as a liaison to the Asian American community and set in motion a series of other conversations about naming Asian Americans to influential jobs. In private, the senator allowed that she had probably been too rough on O'Malley Dillon, who was not really responsible for the administration's defective relationships with Asian American leaders. A few weeks after the clash between Duckworth and O'Malley Dillon, Biden hosted Duckworth and several other Asian American lawmakers, including Judy Chu, Grace Meng, and Mark Decano, in the Oval Office. He conceded that he needed to do better on personnel matters. Again, invoking his lifetime in Washington, the president told the group that one of his most important mentors had been Asian American, Daniel Inouye, the Hawaiian senator and World War II hero of Japanese descent, who served in the Senate for nearly half a century before his death in 2012. For him, Biden said, Inouye had been a teacher. To the group before him, the president said he remained willing to learn, one lawmaker recalls. It was a gracious meeting, and when Biden alluded to Kamala Harris's presence, he did so more gingerly than his aides. When he mentioned the significance of having an Asian American vice president, he quickly added, "I know that's not the only thing you want to hear," according to one attendee. Yet as quickly as it receded, the brief standoff with Duckworth proved a larger point about Biden and his party. While there were plenty of important forces holding the Democratic Party together, there were also powerful interests that could strain party unity. With no room for dissension in the Senate and precious little in the House, that was a looming challenge to the rest of Biden's agenda. And Tammy Duckworth was hardly the most dangerous hostage taker in Congress. The next phase of Biden's agenda was still coming into focus. The president and his party had an enormous to-do list, but many of the biggest items on it had no obvious path through the closely divided Senate. Even with Democrats in the majority in the chamber, they still faced a 60-vote threshold for passing legislation because they would need to break a filibuster in order to end debate and hold a vote. There were not 10 Republican votes available to advance legislation on most of the Democratic Party's governing priorities. Much of the party still dreamed of abolishing the filibuster and turning the Senate into a majority-rule body like the House. But Schumer had canvassed his caucus countless times on the subject, and he knew the votes were not there to change the rules of the Senate. It was not just Manchin and Kyrsten Sinema who objected. As many as half a dozen other, quieter centrists saw the filibuster as a check on raw partisanship and wanted to keep it in place. Besides, Joe Biden himself had never even called for doing away with the filibuster. There were bipartisan talks underway on a few subjects where lawmakers were trying to forge filibuster-proof compromises. In the Senate, the Connecticut Democrat Chris Murphy and the Texas Republican John Cornyn were holding quiet negotiations on gun regulation. A small group of black lawmakers were trying to find a middle ground on police reform. Democrats had empowered Karen Bass in the House and Cory Booker in the Senate to lead bipartisan talks on policing legislation. On the Republican side, Mitch McConnell had promised Tim Scott of South Carolina, the Senate's lone black Republican, that if he could strike a deal, then the GOP leader would not obstruct passage. But at the start of the spring, none of those negotiations seemed on track for a quick breakthrough, and Democrats wanted to keep up the momentum they felt they'd achieved with the rescue plan. Biden and his advisers did nothing to discourage Democrats' great expectations. When Klain met with House progressives on March 23rd and soothed them on the subject of student loans, he renewed the White House's promises to the left on a number of other subjects. The administration was not done fighting for a $15 minimum wage, the chief of staff said, and it intended to push hard as well for a broad bill supporting labor unions, known as the PRO Act. "Keep up the pressure on us," he told progressives, according to a person in the room. Biden, too, was vowing to fight hard for policies that had faint prospects on the Hill. At the start of April, Biden announced a series of executive actions aimed at showing forward motion on liberal priorities, including gun control and restructuring the federal judiciary. He had little enthusiasm for the latter, but during the campaign, he had promised to create a commission to study the composition of the courts to mollify progressives who saw them as hopelessly stacked in favor of the right. In April, Biden gave them that commission. On other subjects, his passion for action was genuine. On April 8th, after calling America's gun violence problem an international embarrassment, Biden huddled in the Oval Office with activists and victims' families and told them he was determined to see Congress enact an assault weapons ban. The cause felt as urgent as ever after recent massacres in Boulder, Colorado, and Atlanta, the second carried out by a white gunman targeting Asian massage parlors. Standing beside the Resolute desk, Biden told his guests that the gun issue was a test of American democracy in the eyes of the world. The United States could not lead other nations if it could not keep people safe at home. By mid-April, Biden had also issued two major policy documents that conveyed the scope of his governing aspirations. On the last day of March, he proposed a $2 trillion infrastructure package. In a discretionary spending request to Congress he released on April 9th, Biden laid out an ambitious blueprint for pumping trillions into education, healthcare, housing, and fighting climate change. Yet, while these announcements excited many Democrats, it was not clear whether they amounted to much more than simple political posturing. Biden still had not devised a fresh strategy for getting large-scale legislation through Congress, and the divisions that had afflicted his party through the winter had not simply vanished. While he was getting pressure from the left to move fast and keep going big, Biden was also hearing signs of discomfort from the middle of his party. Centrists in the House and Senate, who were wary of plunging into another multi-trillion-dollar spending fight and who wanted Biden to make good on his promise to reach across the aisle. There were concerning signs among the moderates in the Senate. While moderate Democrats celebrated the rescue plan along with their more liberal colleagues, some had been annoyed by the way Schumer and the White House had managed the process, with what they saw as a constant determination to soothe the left. At one point, Even the level-headed Chris Coons had vented frustration at Schumer for his continued public pledge to pass a $15 minimum wage, and his insistence on putting the measure to a vote when everyone knew it simply could not pass. No Democratic senator was more discomforting to the White House in this period than Kyrsten Sinema. After the passage of the rescue plan, the aloof Arizonan had reached out to the White House with a jarring request. While the first-term senator had voted for the rescue plan, Sinema asked Biden's aides not to send the president to Arizona for his victory lap. She did not want to be associated with him too closely. It was a puzzling demand, since Biden had carried Arizona and remained popular there in the early months of his term. White House aides were quickly approaching the conclusion that Sinema was simply a difficult person. The senator had been in Washington for 8 years, six of them in the House, and the stories about her were already legion. A former Green Party activist who had reinvented herself as a Fortune 500-loving moderate, Sinema had bewildered her colleagues in Congress long before she flummoxed the Biden White House. One House Democrat with ties to Biden still marveled about an early interaction with Sinema after learning of the up-from-poverty personal story she unspooled on the campaign trail. When this lawmaker told her that he had heard a moving account of her biography on NPR, Sinema responded in a way that seemed to belittle voters for caring. "Can you believe they go for all that bullshit?" she had replied, according to this Democrat. Later, during her 2018 Senate campaign, the New York Times and the Washington Post reported that Sinema appeared to have embellished her life story. Democrats knew, too, that Sinema had close relationships with Republicans on the Hill. Before her election to the Senate in 2018, she had enjoyed aisle-crossing friendships in the House and joked with Democrats about how easy it was for her to charm Republican men. Sinema, a fitness enthusiast who was 36 when she entered Congress, boasted knowingly to colleagues and aides that her cleavage had an extraordinary persuasive effect on the uptight men of the GOP. She told one House Republican that while she would never switch parties, her father would be delighted if she did. After the 2020 election, Sinema became especially chummy with Republicans in the evenly split Senate, and she began to emerge as a power in her own right. During one late-night vote early in 2021, a group of Senate Republicans invited her to dine with them, and Sinema accepted, provided she could enter through a back door and avoid being spotted by the press. She had bonded that evening with Mike Lee, the hard-line conservative Utah senator, about their shared Mormon upbringing and experience attending Brigham Young University. Displaying a side of herself she concealed from the press, Sinema confided that her family had tried to nudge her back to the faith she had long since abandoned. Republicans quickly came to see Sinema as a steadfast ally on crucial structural matters in the Senate, most of all, the preservation of the filibuster, the minority party's most valuable instrument for constraining Democrats. Sinema's interaction with the White House, meanwhile, would only grow more awkward. In the spring, she became the first ever lawmaker to argue with White House aides when they asked her to wear a face mask in the company of the president, repeatedly asking why that was necessary when she had been vaccinated. Still, the White House had no choice but to deal with her, no matter how many red flags were flying. House moderates conveyed a more deliberate message of unease to White House aides in a meeting on April 21st. A month after Klain sat down with some of the most prominent leftists in the House, the chief of staff hosted lawmakers from the centrist New Democrat Coalition for a meeting that also included Ricchetti and Louisa Terrell, Biden's director of legislative affairs. The mostly genial session turned tense when the moderate legislators complained that they saw the White House catering too much to the left. The White House seemed to see progressives as its natural allies, they said. But moderate Democrats shared Biden's worldview in a deeper way, and it had been their victories in 2018 that gave Biden's party control of the House to begin with. "We're on your team," said Derek Kilmer of Washington State, a leader of the group, according to one person in the room. "You can trust us." Chrissy Houlihan, a moderate military veteran from the purple suburbs of Philadelphia, pushed a bit harder. She had voted for plenty of party-line bills so far, Houlihan said, but she believed in bipartisanship and so did her district. "Especially with such a slim majority that we have," Houlihan recalls saying, We need to have the opportunity to be able to show the American people that we aren't just working with our side of the bench, but that we're working with everybody. Klain tried to assure the group that the administration embraced their perspective, that the White House was not simply an arm of the Congressional Progressive Caucus. Biden and his team wanted to be seen as solving problems and doing big things, he said, not just veering ever leftward. I want to make it clear we're a pragmatic operation, Klain insisted, according to one attendee. As for bipartisanship, Klain pointed out that the White House was engaged in talks with Republicans on a major infrastructure bill at that very moment. The GOP was not interested in backing Biden's $2 trillion plan, but a group of senior Republicans in the Senate had opened negotiations about trying to meet in the middle. Ricchetti and other Biden aides had embraced the Republican overture, and Klain had put some work into reopening a bipartisan line of communication. In Klain's case, that meant doing some cleanup after his role enacting the American Rescue Plan. The chief of staff had been an unapologetic proponent of passing the rescue package on a party-line vote. He had shared his view on social media, retweeting columns that critiqued talks with Republicans as a waste of time and promoting an interview in which Schumer called it a mistake to negotiate with Susan Collins. The Maine senator had taken it personally, and she told Klain as much in a late March phone call. Klain was quick to express regret, but Collins chided him on other matters, too. She had been the only Republican to vote for one of Biden's most contentious nominees, the low-profile health secretary, Javier Becerra, and she never got a single call of thanks. If Biden wanted to work with Republicans, she suggested, perhaps his aides should act like it. By the time the new Democrats visited the White House, Biden's staff was indeed acting like they were interested in dealing with the GOP. Earlier that week, there had been glimmers of progress on an infrastructure deal. A gang of Democratic and Republican senators was meeting the leaders of the House Problem Solvers Caucus, the New Jersey Democrat Josh Gottheimer and the Pennsylvania Republican Brian Fitzpatrick. The most committed dealmakers in the group hoped they could hammer out an agreement to spend about $800 billion on infrastructure. But on April 22nd, the day after Klain met with the new Democrats, Senate Republicans made a formal offer to the White House that fell far short of that figure. They released an infrastructure proposal that totaled just $568 billion, barely a quarter of what Biden had proposed. To people in both parties who wanted a deal, this looked like the rescue plan talks all over again. A low-ball offer that would anger congressional Democrats and make it easy for Biden to walk away. As Biden's administration approached its 100-day mark, the economy and the coronavirus case numbers both seemed headed in the right direction. Biden was considerably more popular than his predecessor, but there was no sign yet that his policies were attracting new support. In a poll released several days before his 100th day, The Washington Post and ABC News found 52% of the country approved of his performance so far. It was an illustration of how polarized the country was, that the opposition to Biden was already so cemented in place that he had not enjoyed the honeymoon in popular opinion afforded nearly every previous president except his immediate predecessor. Very few voters were up for grabs. In private, Klain said the poll was somewhat disappointing, but he hoped the numbers would move with time. Perhaps, the chief of staff suggested, the public just needed more time to see the results of the administration's work. Before his address to a joint session of Congress on April 28th, Biden announced another multi-trillion-dollar spending package to go along with the massive infrastructure proposal he had unveiled at the start of the month. This one, branded the American Family Plan, represented a massive expansion of American social welfare programs, including universal pre-kindergarten, free community college, and a permanent extension of the child tax credits contained in the rescue plan. It was a set of proposals that could only pass on a party-line vote, and even that seemed like a stretch. Republicans would not back Biden's plans, and the centrist wing of the president's party was giving every signal that he could not yet count on their support. Yet, in a meeting with news anchors hours before his address on the Hill, Biden said he had not given up on bipartisanship. By his own reckoning, he had already shown an unusual capacity for bringing together fractious political partners. I mean, we talk about, you know, can you unite the parties, Biden told the group. Well, I united the Democratic Party, and no one thought it could happen, and pretty damn quickly.